Hello, friends, and welcome to Through These Doors, a Fame Recording Studios podcast. I'm your host, Rodney Hall, with Fame Recording Studios, where it all started in Muscle Shoals. And together, we'll be digging deep into the history of Fame Recording Studios and the Muscle Shoals sound, with the musicians, engineers, producers, and music insiders that have turned this small town into a music landmark known around the world. Welcome. Let's get it on.
All right. Welcome to this month's version of Through These Doors. Today we have the legendary musician, producer, Mr. Clayton Ivey, who was a member of the Fame Gang, original member, and he was also the co-founder and owner of Wishbone Recording Studios, which was had much success here in the Shoals, and Clayton's played on hundreds of millions of records sold, and I'm just going to get into a little bit of that today, and welcome, Clayton. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here, Rodney.
I appreciate you, my friend.
Hey, buddy.
So I've known Clayton since I was probably four. I guess you moved here in 1970, isn't that right?
69.
So yeah, I was three.
Yeah, I remember you, Rodney.
About to be four. Yeah, I'm sure you saw a few things.
I saw a few things.
Through the years, yeah, I'm sure you saw me get my ass beat a few times.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Well, it's great to have you, Clayton. Just wanted to have you on and get some insight into your history and to the your role in Muscle Shoals music, which has been a huge one. Well, so yes. Tell me first, how did you get to Muscle Shoals? What brought you here?
1966, we came to Fame. Well, I came up there with Don Schroeder, and we were going to cut James and Bobby Purified. This is right after I'm Your Puppet.
Right.
And I showed up, Schroeder showed up. Everybody showed up to the studio except the Purifies. They didn't show up. So we cut a record on Don Schroeder instead. And
oh, wow.
That was December of 66. So, and 2 years later, your dad gave me a call and asked me, do I want to be part of the rib section at Fame? I said, I'll be there. And that's how I got here.
So, yeah, I've seen that Don Schroeder record around. I think it's a song called I'm Hurtin', maybe. And
I believe so.
Sweet Violets, something like that. Seems like
it wasn't a bad record, it just wasn't James and Bobby Purified.
Right. So that was your first session here. What was your first session as part of the rhythm, as part of the Fame Gang rhythm section?
Oh God, let's see. That was probably this act on Stax. Israel Talbert was his name, and great artist. Sang his tail off. I think that was probably one of the first ones.
I think that master's sitting right here by me somewhere.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, it was a funky record.
I know, I've seen it, yeah.
Me and Jesse and Freeman.
Yeah, so who was, tell me about the formation of the Fame Gang. So you, was that going on, the Swampers had already left at that point when
they left, and what happened was, I was at my ex-wife's home in Funiac Springs, Florida, and I don't know this day how your daddy got that number, but he did.
Oh, he was good at that stuff.
He was great at it. And he called me and asked me, come up and let's just try it out. And he says, can you bring a bass player? And I said, yeah, I can bring a hell of a bass player, which was Jesse Boyce. And Jesse and I got on a plane. It's the first time Jesse ever flew. And we and we got on one of those old Martin 404s and left Pensacola, flew to here, to Muscle Shoals, and got off, and the rest is history. That was March of 69.
Yeah, that's when the guys left. So where was Jesse? Was he? And you were in Pensacola, right?
He was at Don Schroeder's place in Pensacola. That's where we all were working.
Gotcha.
He and I, Moses Dillard, a drummer for James Brown. His name was Harold Walker. They called him Jabbo. Right. Great drummer.
So what were those early days like? Did he sign you to exclusive contracts and you're clocking in, all that stuff?
Oh, yes. Of course he did.
Well, he didn't do that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
As I say, he didn't do that with the Swampers and he regretted it.
No, and that's why he did it with us.
See? Yeah, exactly.
And but anyway, it was cool. The way I looked at it was this. You know, I mean, the first 6 months, I mean, Rick was hard to work with. Because he was Rick Hall and he did things his way, which today I look back on it and say, you know, it don't matter which way he did it, it worked. And because he was rough, but I'll tell you this, I had two choices. After about 6 months, I said, you know, this is really hard to put up with. I said, but I can either leave, I can stay here, or I can go back home to Florida. And if I stay here, I can learn all I can from this man. And I mean, learn it all. And I did, and I stayed for 2 more years and till everybody's contract was up. And, what was funny is when all the contracts were up, Rick called me upstairs, and he and Wes Farrell was up there. Wes on the, I can't remember what label it was. And anyway, Rick kept telling me, man, he said, I'll double your salary, I'll do all this, and I'll do this. And Wes Farrell looks at Rick and says, Rick, don't you know when a man don't want to work for you? And from that point on, I said, look, man, just call me anytime you need my help and I'll be there. And that's the way it worked out with us. And that's the way, and we always had a great relationship, me and Rick. Yeah. And Rick Hall, I guarantee you, was one of the funniest guys on this planet. I mean, he really was. I mean, he was a funny guy.
He was. When he was on, he was absolutely funny. But when he was pissed, you didn't want to be around.
When he was pissed, everybody was in his sights.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody. You just wanted to make eye contact.
Everybody talks about these stories about, well, if you're in there overdubbing, he'd get on top and say, look, if you can't do it, I got somebody in the lobby that can. And by God, he did. There was somebody in the lobby in case you couldn't do it. So pressure was on, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you guys were cutting hit records. And that was all it was to him. It was like, how many your last hit? You hadn't had a hit.
That's it. You know, there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Absolutely. Once you lose that momentum, it's harder to get it back than
It's tough. But I'll tell you what he did. He told those guys, at least he told me this, he told those guys when they left that, you know, he can cut a hit with anybody, any musicians. And I think that was really on his mind. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Here's a whole new set of players who at the time were really not studio players, but we were good players.
Right.
And we didn't have that studio thing down like Roger and them did, but I mean, right out of the chute, here's Patches. And right out of the chute, man, and there it is. And I know that made him feel good when that record took off.
Oh, yeah.
Because he proved to them that, hey, I can do this. And he did it.
Yeah, pretty immediately. That was
real quick.
I think that was January of 70, maybe.
God, that was long ago, 51 years.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
God almighty, man.
Insane. So the Osmonds were one of the first groups you worked with. Tell me about working with those guys. What was that like?
I'll tell you what. The Osmonds, those kids. Donnie was 11, let's put it that way. And they were kids.
Oh, yeah.
That was the most professional group of kids I've ever seen. Because when they came here to the studio, They had this Las Vegas show that they did, and it was all on tape. So they put it on tape machine and ran through the playback speakers and did the whole show on the floor for us.
Really?
And it was the damnest thing I ever seen, man.
Wow.
And Okay, of course, then we started cutting tracks, and George Jackson had this song, One Bad Apple. We listened to it, cut this track, and you know, I've never heard anybody since then sing this high like Donnie did. I mean, Donnie, I thought Michael Jackson sang high.
Right.
Like on Ben.
Mm-hmm.
But on One Bad Apple, man, Donnie's in the stratosphere.
Yeah.
And I think, as a matter of fact, I think Rick might have got some calls from Barry Gordy about that.
I think that he did.
I know he did.
I think he got a telegram.
Yes, he did.
Stop stealing my effing music.
Yeah, right on the intro music, man. Hell
yeah.
It's everybody's music.
And yeah, but yeah, they were just kids. They were absolutely just kids. Well, I think that may have been my dad's most amazing production was, he took a barbershop quartet and turned them into the Jackson Five.
Sure did.
You know?
And I'll tell you what was another amazing thing about those kids, man. As young as they were, he had Earl Brown, who was a vocal arranger in L.A., fly in to write a score for these kids, right?
Yep.
And in the back, they was all doing background on One Bad Apple and Go Away Little Girl and stuff like that on Donnie stuff.
Right.
But anyway, man, he put this score up there and they sang it. I mean, sang it down. They did. I mean, let's count it off. And they did it. I said, good God, these kids, I mean, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old.
Right.
And they can do it, man. And they did it.
Absolutely.
And I saw some film of them in London where, I mean, it was like, they were like the Beatles
in
London.
It was absolutely.
Amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah, they sold 15 or 16 million records in 1 year. And, you know, and y'all started doing doing Donnie solo records.
Oh, God.
And, you know.
You must admit, Donnie was a cute kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was looking at some video on YouTube today. It was just like, oh, my God, man. I mean, it's.
Well, I'm telling you, and every 14-year-old girl love this kid.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, 5-6 years old, and I remember going to see them in Memphis, and it was just like, oh, my God.
Oh, I know. You know,
20,000 12-year-old girls screaming at the top of their lungs.
I mean, it's crazy.
It was.
It
was bedlam.
I mean, they did it.
So about that same time, you know, it's kind of ironic, the artists you guys were working with. You know, you're working with Clarence Carter, who's blind, the Osmonds, who are just kids. Then Little Richard comes along.
Now,
what was that like? And what do you remember that any of the townspeople seeing him and what their reaction was to Little Richard?
I do remember this. I know he had 34 wigs. I remember that. And Richard, I mean, there was not a, how do I say this? There's not a bashful bone in his body.
Right.
Richard was Little Richard, and he was king of rock and roll, and he let everybody know it.
Oh, yeah.
He was.
Absolutely.
But he was fun to work with, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he always had something going on. I mean, it was funny. There's some things I can't say.
you have to tell me that privately.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah. So he was a great keyboard player.
He was a good
and
he
you really were a keyboard was, player. So what did you play Wurlitzer and he played piano?
I was the first piano player to ever play on his record that he didn't play on.
Wow. So he didn't play at all on that record?
No, he didn't know. No, I played everything.
He just sang.
He just sang and he had a ball.
Wow.
He'd be out in the middle of the floor kicking up dust.
I didn't know that.
Oh, man.
I thought he probably played on it. That's amazing.
Funny dude, boy.
That's amazing. So Kelvin asked me to ask you tell the story about getting behind Little Richard on Broadway.
Oh, in Nashville.
Yeah.
I was sitting at a red light there on Broadway one day, and I seen this Suburban coming out of a side street, a black Suburban, and it was just moving about 5 miles an hour. You know, Richard didn't drive. He couldn't drive.
Right.
But anyway, I looked and I saw this Richard driving this Suburban. And he had all the traffic stopped. And he come out there real slow. And I realized who it was. And I said, Richard. I said, it's Clyde. And he said, hey, Clyde. And kept on going around. And the cops didn't do nothing, man. They just let him go.
So Clyde was your nickname, Little Richard.
He nicknamed me Clyde, man.
Yeah.
He did. And from then on, it stuck for 51 years.
Because he couldn't
remember Clayton, see?
I know. Yeah.
Funny man.
That is funny. So you're on the Bobby Gentry Fancy Sessions too, right?
Oh, yeah. Did that one too, man.
Yeah.
That was. So
y'all did Fancy. Do you remember when you first heard that song? Did she play you? I know there was a really long version of it. Is that what you heard? Or
what, Fancy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I know there was like 8 verses or something.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, and of course, your daddy cut all that, half of that mess out.
Right.
That's another thing he was good at.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you what, Rick, there's two guys that I've worked with that he was on the same level as far as knowing songs. And that's Jerry Wexler and Quincy Jones. They knew a good song, a great song from a good song.
See right. What I'm saying? Yeah, yeah.
Most people don't know that, but they knew it. And he did. And he ended up cutting that thing in half.
Yeah.
It was still long for the period. I mean, hell, it seemed to be 4 minutes long almost, I guess.
Yeah, back then. That's a great record. I loved you listening to that record, all the little nuances and things.
Just take it and analyze it.
Yeah.
Listen to it. And here's the part that really gets you, if you dig what I'm saying. Your daddy was sitting, when we was cutting that track, he's got this old Universal Audio console with a big old black knobs, right? And he's sitting there, and he's mixing this as we cut.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's mixing this record as we cut it. And what you hear on radio was what he was mixing when we cut it.
Yeah.
Everybody can't do that.
No. That's crazy. If you listen to that record, you hear what we're saying. It's pretty pretty phenomenal. I tell you, there's nothing that irks me worse than hearing somebody bring up Fancy and they say, oh, yeah, Reba McEntire. I'm like, oh, my God.
Oh, Lord, mercy.
It's
not even close. Not even the same part.
It's not even close. And, you know, they inducted Bobby into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, and they played the Reba version of that song when they
– Are you serious?
I'm serious as a heart attack.
No, man.
Are you kidding me?
Are you serious?
Yeah. They played the Reba version. I was just like, man, y'all don't.
Let me tell you something. Well, I'm better. We'll stop there with Reba.
Okay. So, Mac Davis was another artist y'all did a bunch of work with.
Yeah.
How was Mac to work with?
Mac was, Mac was a great, great songwriter, man. I mean, to prove my point, we cut this, he had this melody and I wrote these chords down and we cut this track on Baby Don't Get Hooked on Me. It didn't have any lyrics whatsoever. And we cut the track, he loved it. And he went over and sat on the steps going to control room A, sat on those steps and wrote that song in 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah,
and your daddy like drove him crazy about writing me a hook song.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm gonna write Rick a hook song. So he did. Baby, don't get hooked on me.
Yeah, shut him up.
Yeah.
Mac says when he first came up with the idea that it was just kind of a joke. He was just like, here's your song. Here's your hook song, Rick.
And Rick loved it.
as would have it. Yeah. So, A great album you guys worked on that doesn't get a lot of acclaim, I think, is the Lou Rawls album.
You know, I'll tell you what's really funny about that. I don't even have a copy of that album.
Really?
No. You all have any over there?
Studio? Well, we got one. I could probably find you one though.
And what's funny is there's a Lou Rawls album, another Lou Rawls album that I did with Ron Hafkin in Nashville, and I don't even remember doing that one. And I got it in and I was playing it the other day. I said, I don't even remember playing on this record.
Yeah.
I remember playing on that record with Fame.
Right.
But I've never heard the whole album finished.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you.
But he was great.
It wasn't a bit. I don't think it was a huge album. It had Bring It On Home. It was kind of a Sam Cooke tribute,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
Had Bring It On Home to me.
Yeah.
And apparently, my dad told me that there was a guy producing the record. I think it was David Axelrod. Is that his name?
Yeah.
And he got here, and he got word that his son had committed suicide that day.
Really?
And had to leave the sessions. Yeah.
Huh. I think David worked at Capitol, didn't he?
I think so.
Back then, I believe he did, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite Fame artists was Candy Staten.
Oh yeah.
Y'all played her. She was on Fame Records. The Fame Gang had a record out on Fame Records.
Right.
And which was all through Capitol.
Right.
Fame had left, or my dad had left, or had pissed Wexler off and stopped working with him. He went to Capitol and did a deal with Fame Records, and Candy was one of the flagship artists of that label.
Yeah.
What was working with Candy like? She's always been a sweetheart to me.
No, Candy was great, man. I mean, this girl could sing. I mean, she was way ahead of her time.
Right.
I mean, just really could sing and great human being. And it's just, She was fun, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of fun. And could really
sing.
Yeah,
she was.
Really sing.
Beautiful.
All of her. She was the whole package.
Mm-hmm. She was. And is. She's still a sweetheart.
Yeah.
So I understand, I've heard that Clarence is not doing really well.
That's what I heard.
Clarence Carter.
Yeah.
Who we love and is mainstay in Muscle Shoals. He's come back. He came back and did his last few albums with us. So he's always been around. But what a great guy. Blind and went to the school for the blind down in Talladega and
And it was in the group Five Blind Boys of Alabama.
Was he in that group?
Yes, sir.
Really?
Sure was.
I did not know that. Mm-hmm. And then he had a duet, Clarence and Calvin, and then apparently, I think Calvin got shot by his wife or something, had to quit. So then it became Clarence, who obviously had Slip Away, which you played on Slip Away, right? And 2 Weeks to Fight?
No, I played on 2 Weeks to Fight. I didn't play on Slip Away.
Okay.
I played on 2 Weeks to Fight, though.
And Patches. That album.
Yeah, Snatching It Back.
Very cool. Did you ever play on Wilson Pickett Records?
Yeah. Hey Joe album.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. Now there's a screamer there, man.
Oh, I'm telling you.
I mean, this guy, everybody talks about James Brown can scream. No.
Oh, no.
Pickett could scream.
Absolutely. In tune.
But I'll tell you what, you couldn't play on his session. If you couldn't come in, other words, you couldn't bring no peanuts in there.
Right.
Because as a kid growing up, that's all he did was pick peanuts and stack them.
Really?
He didn't want to be no part of no peanut. And don't bring no peanuts in his record because you can't come in with them. That's just the way it was.
That is funny.
He could do it, man. Your daddy put some good records on him, too.
Yeah, he did. He did. And he loved Pickett. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. They did the Etta James stuff before you came, right?
Right before I came. But yeah. I did overdub on Tell Mama.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's cool.
And your dad had me in there overdubbing Oregon one day.
So, yeah, that probably would, I guess, on the basic tracks would have been Barry.
Yeah, on the original, yeah.
Yeah. Spooner, maybe.
Might have been Spooner, yeah. I think Spooner went to Memphis. in 67 or 68.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Dan Penn.
Yeah. So at what point did you start working over at Muscle Shoals Sound?
Well, I took about a year off from your father. And I just took a year off to freelance, to play
right. Everywhere.
And Jimmy Johnson sent word down there. I was over to this other little studio called Widget. Sent a word down there. He wanted to talk to me. So I went up there and he said, would you be interested in coming to work with the rhythm section? I said, I'd love to. I mean, they were busy.
Yeah.
I wasn't that busy. And all of a sudden, it's just crazy. We did three sessions every day for 4 or 5 years. And just, I tell you when I knew I was working too much one day, I was riding down in front of the Holiday Inn. What street is that?
Avalon? Patch.
Yeah. That's right. And I heard back-to-back records that we'd cut, and I played the same lick on the same record. I said, I got to slow down. I said, I hope I'm the only one who heard that.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's I think it was 72 or 73.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and, you were over there for a while, and then
I even stayed there after I built my own place. It was part of the rhythm section.
Right. So tell me about the formation. You founded Wishbone with Terry Woodford. Tell me about that.
And when I was working at Muscle Shoals Sound, he run their publishing company.
Right.
And we got to talking one day. Well, you know, let's form our own production company. And I said, well, you know, let me think about it. And I thought about it. And we did. And had a production company for, about a year. And then we cut this guy named Reuben Howell. We cut this record, Rings. Alex Harvey wrote a song. And ring, ring, a telephone ring. Somebody says that one. And Barry Gordy heard it and loved it. And told Suzanne DePass, who run Motown at the time, to buy us. So, but what they were, and we were the first white production company to ever have a deal with Motown. And after we got out of that, we did that for 3 years, which was really, you learn a lot when you work for Motown.
Yeah. So
you work and you find out that, you know, this is not working out like we thought. And one day I walked by the president of Motown, who was Jay Lasker, then who owned ABC Dunhill prior to being president of Motown.
Right.
And I asked Jay, I told Jay, get me out of here. Right. And it cost me and Terry a lot of money. It cost $100,000.
Yeah.
But that's when we decided to build a studio out by the airport.
Okay. And so you didn't have a studio?
No, we didn't have a studio until we got left Motown.
Right. Okay. So who did you, when you were working with Motown, who did you work with?
Everybody. I got to work with everybody.
Yeah.
Stevie's office was right across the hall from ours.
Stevie Wonder.
He had a piano and I had a piano. We used to play piano together.
Really?
Every day.
How cool is that?
That's cool, man. He called me in there one day. He said, I had to come here. And I went in there, man. He said, I'm going to play you a song. I want you to cut it on me. And I'm thinking already, this is BS. Anyway, he had a big old box, a box of Kentucky Fried Chicken. He had that chicken all over his ass. I mean, he had grease everywhere. He played me the worst country song I ever heard in my life. And I said, I'm not going to do it. You cut it on yourself. I said, I wouldn't cut that piece of stuff for nothing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we did that all the time. And I was, me and Terry, this is what's so cool. Terry and I, he had just finished this new album, Love in the Key of Life. Remember that one? It was a double album.
Right.
He had on a black, it was a brown cover, he had on a robe.
Yeah. Yeah, songs in the Key of Life.
Right, that album. We heard that album before anybody heard that album.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we went up to Ebert Abner's office, who was president of Motown then, after Jay left. Right. And we went in there, and he was going to play for Ebert because they were having serious... Stevie was holding the album out for money.
Right.
See, Stevie's album sales paid everybody's salary at Motown.
Right.
Just his album sales.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We went in there, and he just put that album on, started playing it. I said, good God. That was a whole different genre of music to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I've never heard anything like this.
Right.
And Ebert made a bad mistake. He got up, walked out of the office, and didn't think Stevie knew it. I said, son, you just tore it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we get through playing the album, go back down to Stevie's office. He said, now I'm gonna get Ebert on the phone. He said, I'm gonna tell you something. He said, I want you to say, Stevie wants a Mercedes. Just keep saying it while I'm hanging the phone up. But he pissed him off, man. And we did that. By God, he had a new Mercedes the next day. And he said, Clay, you want to go downstairs? I said, you going to go down and look at that car? I said, yeah. He said, and he got in the driver's side. He said, get in. We're going for a ride. I said, are you out of your damn mind? He said, no. He said, I ain't going to go far. And he drove about 5 feet. And that's the story of Stevie. But we did have the Temptations, everybody. It was fun. That part was fun, man.
Right.
I mean, that label had all my favorite artists on it.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. Good God, they had everybody.
Smokey Robinson, Supremes.
I did an album on the Supremes. And of course, Donnie wasn't with them. Sherry Payne was the lead singer. But
right.
He was really a great singer.
Right.
But it was fun, and then we got out of that deal with Motown and built the studio, and the rest of it is what it is.
Yeah, you had some success there. You had Hot, had a big record on Hot.
We cut LeBlanc Carr record there, Falling.
Yeah, huge.
And there was 4 or 5 records, big records cut there.
Well, my favorite thing that came out of that era was Mac McAnally, who's still killing it and still working.
Mac came to us when he was 18 years old, and our engineer Steve Moore at the time said, I got this artist I want you to hear. I said, well, bring him here, man. So he brought Mac into the control room, and Mac played me 4 or 5 songs off to that first album,
right,
with Barney on it and all that stuff.
Crazy World.
And I called back there to Terry. I said, Terry, you need to get around here right now. I said, you need to come hear this. And of course, we signed him back to a contract, did 4 albums for Areola. And Mac is great. That's all you can say.
Absolutely.
He ain't nothing else to say about it. He's what he is.
Yep.
And
he's still doing great albums. Yeah, great. Still amazing.
He is, man.
All these years later.
I'm telling you.
You guys did well in publishing up there. You had Mac. You had Old Flame.
Oh, we had Mac.
Who wrote Old Flame, the Alabama hit.
Donnie Lottie, who wrote it with him.
Huge, yeah.
I tell you what's a funny story about that. It was about 11 o'clock at one night. I was tired, man. I've been there all day working on something. And Mac and Donnie walks in. And they just got out of bed.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going home. I don't want to hear nobody's songs. I'm tired. And they said, no, you got to hear this. So they played me Old Flames. I said, oh, God, wait a minute. And I said, play it again.
Yeah.
They did. And we cut it the next day at 4 o'clock on Alabama.
At Wishbone?
No, at Music Mill in Nashville. Okay. I went and played the intro on it.
Wow.
And
yeah, that's a classic intro too.
And actually it was Max. And I just played what he played.
Right, right.
But
what a great record. But yeah, y'all had some other,
we had
Brassfield. Bobby. Yeah, Brassfield.
Yeah, had Tommy Brassfield and Robert Byrne was another one of my favorites.
Oh yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
Robert was the best ballad writer I ever knew.
Yeah.
I mean, he could write a ballad. So.
Yeah. Well, honestly, the best thing that probably ever happened to my dad's publishing company was you guys going out of business.
Yeah, two of my guys.
He picked up Tommy and Robert had a lot of success with them.
The song that Tommy and Walt wrote for Millsap is still one of my favorite records of all time.
There's no getting over me.
No getting over me, man. God, what a record.
Yeah, great record.
Oh, mercy, it was a great
that was record. That was Walt's.
What's funny is I played on it.
Really?
Yes.
That was Walt's first cut, and it was.
Are you serious?
Yeah, freaking song of the year.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
It was very first cut. It came out the day the single came out the day he got married.
No kidding.
Sure did.
It's a damn good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
Yeah. Hey, that's the way it works.
Yeah, it is. Well, I got, let's see. I got one more question. Word on the street is you have a fancy new boathouse that you're having a big party at coming up soon.
Well, I got a fancy boathouse that's about half built. And once we get it finished, we'll have a party.
That's what David Hood told me to tell you.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be great, man. It is.
I hear you. Those things are a pain in the butt, man. It takes forever. To even say they'll do it.
Here's what's cool. The builder that builds all these boathouses out here lives next door.
Ah.
And he had his all their survey equipment out there one day, right? I said, what you got all this stuff for? He says, because you live next door. He said, I don't do this to everybody. He said, but I want yours left. I said, you know why? Because this old man will be over knocking on your door. Just starting to say
that's right.
That's exactly right.
But that is right.
He's a good guy, man. He knows how to build a boathouse.
Yep. I hear you. Who is it?
I'm sorry.
Who is it?
Glenn Bramlett.
Glenn Bramlett. I hear you. All right. Shout out to Glenn.
Bill, call him.
I'm going to call him and get him to sponsor this now.
That's what you should do.
Well, all right. Well, I appreciate you, Clayton, and thank you for being here. We love you, man.
And you too, boy.
You're a big part of Muscle Shoals history, and man, it's just it's an honor to have you around, still playing and showing these young guys how to do it.
It's still fun, man.
It is fun. It's always fun to have you in the house.
It's good talking to you too.
All right, buddy. Have a good afternoon.
You too, bud.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.